Good morning, Calvary. It is so good to be back with you. I have missed you this month. This month we've been in Uganda as a family. Andrew Littman and the team with I Choose You led a trip out to Uganda. We joined them and we're going to share more about what happened next week in service. But today we're going to continue our series by faith. Thankful for Gary and for Jay teaching the last couple of weeks, looking at characters in the Old Testament that help reveal the character of God. It's important to know who God is. And then it reveals the nature of humanity, and then it unfolds the plan of God to redeem all things and restore all things back to right relationship as we saw in the beginning in Eden. And so we're going to look at another episode today that does those same things, reveals the character of God, the nature of humanity, and the plan of redemption. We're going to look at an episode through the life of Moses. There is so much to be said of Moses. It's hard to pick one episode. But I chose one that talks about an issue that many people struggle with today. In fact, it is an uncertain world, is it not? We're watching the news unfold and wondering what could happen next. And one of the most distressing things that can happen to you in a dysfunctional world is to lack an identity. If you don't know who you are, you are unable to live out of an identity with passion and purpose, with discernment and direction, with mission and vision for your life. And identity informs all of those things. And so if you lack identity, you lack mission, vision, passion, purpose. And you spend your life trying to do things, acquire things, accomplish things to gain an identity. In fact, many of us have pursued identities that ended up failing us. We chose identities that worked for a little while, but left us rather empty. When we think about our youth today, one of their biggest struggles is knowing who they are. But once you know who you are, once you know your identity, then you're able to live out of it your life. Do you know who you are today? Do you know the identity that God has given us as the people of God? Do you know what the world needs today from the church? The world needs the church to know who she is and to live into that identity, into a distinct way, to call the world to something other than itself. It does not benefit the world for the church to look just like the world. We need to know who we are. So we're going to look at the life of Moses, and we're going to look at one particular episode where he is helping Israel to understand who they are. The story of Moses is often pictured in a freedom episode, meaning that he is the one leading them out of bondage to freedom. But that's only part of the story. Moses is not only leading freedom, he's leading formation. He is freeing a people as an instrument of God, and he is also forming a people that they would know who they are and how they are to live. So let's grab our Bibles, and we'll go to Exodus chapter 1. Exodus chapter 1 begins this story of Moses right where Jay left off last week with the story of Joseph. Joseph informs us how Israel got to Egypt in the first place. And there they have been fruitful, they've multiplied, they've become a great people there. And yet, there's this line in verse 8, says, now there arose a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph. Joseph has died, and now new leadership in Israel has no knowledge of Joseph, the things that Joseph has done, how life has been preserved through Joseph. And if they don't know Joseph, they don't know Joseph's God. And if they don't know Joseph's God, then they are free to abuse God's people. In fact, this king who knows nothing of Joseph, of how Joseph has blessed Egypt, has helped build Egypt, preserve Egypt, now looks at these Israelites and says, we should do something about these immigrants in our land, lest they become something and join our enemies and wage war against us. And so they set taskmasters over them, and they dealt harshly with them. They afflicted them with many burdens. They became slaves. as God had promised to Father Abraham, as we saw, these people would be afflicted in a foreign country for 400 years. And for these years, Israel was enslaved by Egypt. It became so bad that the leadership of Israel began to kill the offspring of the male children of the Israelite women. They told the midwives to find these children at birth and to kill them, to destroy them, to put them to death. And there's where we enter the story of Moses. Moses was born into this environment of death. Moses was born, and really the Moses story has three sort of seasons to it, and they're all marked by 40 years. 40 is a number that the scriptures use of a time of testing. You think of 40 days in which it rained. You think about the 40 days in which Jesus was in the wilderness. You think about the 40 years that Israelites in the wilderness. 40 is always a mark of testing. And so Moses' life is marked by three seasons of 40. The first is this first 40 years in which he's born into Egypt. This is where he's raised as a prince of Egypt, educated, skilled, knowledgeable. It's where he gains all the knowledge of politics and government and military might. And then there's this season of him in the wilderness of obscurity, in which no one cares about Moses. Moses doesn't have a position of power or influence. He's a shepherd. And then there is this episode of 40 years, and where God calls him again to be an instrument used by God to deliver his people, to free them and form them. And so in the first 40 years of Moses' life, he comes into this world of death. And there's these amazing stories, which we had time for it, of how these women in Moses' life preserve his life, guard his life, and allow his life to flourish. The Hebrew midwives refused to obey Pharaoh's commands, and they would not destroy the male children as Pharaoh commanded them. They had these excuses of, man, these Jewish women, you know, when they go into labor, it's so fast and we can't be there in time. And then you have Moses' mother who hid Moses. You have Moses' sister who preserves Moses on the Nile and presents him in a strategic way to Pharaoh's wife, who then adopts Moses into her family and raises Moses as her own, recruiting Moses' birth mother to be his nursing mother. All of these incredible women of great courage, defying commands of death to give Moses life. And here Moses is raised in Egypt, and there's an episode in his life which ends the mark of 40 years where he sees a Hebrew slave being abused by an Egyptian taskmaster. And he steps in fact, in such a violent way that the Egyptian is killed. And then he sees two Hebrews fighting amongst themselves, and he knows he's a Hebrew, so he tries to step in and help resolve this conflict. And they say, oh, are you going to kill us like you killed the Egyptian? In fear of being known as a murderer, and knowing that Pharaoh would have consequences for him, he flees into the wilderness. And there he comes into Midian, and this is where Moses is formed as a shepherd. This is where he finds a wife. This is where he has children. This is where he has a profession in which he cares for the livestock, the needs of sheep. In 40 years, he lives in obscurity in the wilderness until a moment in time where he is doing what he's done for 40 years and something unusual catches his eye. This is Exodus chapter 3, verse 1. Now Moses was keeping the flock of his father-in-law Jethro, the priest of Midian, and he led his flock to the west side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a flame of fire out of the midst of a bush. He looked, and behold, the bush was burning, yet it was not consumed. And Moses said, I will turn aside to see this great sight, why the bush is not burned. When the Lord saw that he had turned aside to see, God called to him out of the bush, Moses, Moses. And he said, here I am. Then he said, do not come near. Take your sandals off your feet, for the place which you are standing is holy ground. Now Moses has seen bushes on fire before. In fact, there's evidence of how bushes in this area, based on its heat and its arid climate, can combust. But something unusual about this bush is that it's on fire and yet not consumed. Now we might come to it and say, that's just ridiculous. How silly is that? Well, is it? Every day, God puts a sign in the sky of a ball of fire unconsumed. It's like every day there's a burning bush to remind you of God's sustaining presence in your life, that God is active in the affairs of man. He's the one that sustains us. And so Moses sees this event, turns aside, and that's what we are to do. When God is doing something in our life, we are not to continue on in our own path, but we should turn aside and pay attention. And Moses has turned aside and paid attention to what God was up to. And God's instruction is, stop, Moses, take your sandals off, for the ground you're standing on is holy. What makes that ground so holy? What makes it holy is that it's God's presence that there. So the distinguishing mark of the character of God, in which really everything flows out of, is that God is holy, holy, holy. The word holy means set apart. He's not just a bit better than us. No, he is distinguishably different than us. He's set apart in his moral purity, that he is without evil, without fault, without sin. He is perfect in his morality. But he's also set apart wholly in his nature. Ontologically, he's set apart from us. He's not part of creation. He is the creator of all creation. He is wholly, completely, ontologically, morally set apart. And so Moses, where you're standing in the presence of a holy God, is holy. Recognize who you're speaking with. Now the question is, does a holy God who's completely set apart from us care about the affairs of men? And the answer is yes. This holy God is intimately aware of the sufferings of his people. And so chapter 3, verse 7, then the Lord said, I have surely seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt, and I have heard their cry because of their taskmasters. I know their sufferings, and I have come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of the land to a good and broad land, a land flowing with milk and with honey. This holy God sees the problem. If you've ever wondered if God sees you, you have to know the character of God is that he does. He has heard your prayers. He sees your grief. He knows your sorrows. And he has come down. The holy God is intimately aware of your life and of your needs and is with you. And what he tells Moses is, I have seen it, I'm aware of it, and now we're going to do something about it. And what he calls Moses to do is to be the instrument of his grace, of deliverance. He says, come, I will send you to Pharaoh that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. But Moses said to God, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the children of Israel out of Egypt? And he said, but I will be with you, and this shall be a sign for you that I have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall serve God on this same mountain. On this mountain. And he says to Moses, Moses, I've chosen you, come, you're going to be sent back to Egypt. Now this is what we've seen in all of these stories, in which God is committed to working out his purposes and plans through human agency or with humans in partnership. He's always calling men, calling women to partner with him to accomplish his purposes. And so he calls out to Moses, you're my chosen instrument to go to Egypt and free my people. And Moses says, who am I to go? And I think, what's in Moses' mind? I think it's through these 40 years of the wilderness, back to those last moments in Egypt. When he says, who am I to go? He's probably thinking, God, time out. I was already there. And as a prince of Egypt, in a position of power, with strength, I already tried to do this. Remember? I stepped in and tried to execute justice. When I saw the Israelites being mistreated, I tried to step in when brothers were fighting and resolve conflict, and they rejected me. When I was a prince, I've been in the wilderness for 40 years. I'm a shepherd now. They've forgotten about me. Who am I now? if I couldn't do it then, who am I now to do it? And the answer is, it's not about who you are, Moses. It's about who I am. I am who I am. And the answer is that I am with you. That's what he says. I will be with you. It is my strength, not yours, that brings my people out of slavery. That last episode was you on your own. Now it's me with you. God's strength, the I am, who will bring my people out. And this will be a sign of my faithfulness to you, is that when you bring them out, the success of that is that you will be right back here on this mountain. And so Moses goes with Aaron back to Egypt. And you guys know these stories of the ways in which God demonstrates his sovereignty over all these little G gods of Egypt. The god of the sun, in which God gives a plague of darkness, the gods of the Nile, the gods of livestock, the gods of harvest. Even Pharaoh himself is being seen as God and his offspring. One by one, God demonstrates his power and authority and sovereignty over every god of Egypt. For he alone is holy. And finally, Pharaoh realizes that he is face to face with the only true God. And he says to Moses, leave. Take your people and leave. And so Egypt blesses them, really just gives them all of their resources, golds and all sorts of material wealth, livestock, and says, get out of Egypt. We don't want you or your God here. And they enter the wilderness and they come back to the mountain, just like God promised. He's the promise maker. God is the faithful promise keeper. And so here is Moses now at the mountain with the people of God who have been freed. Now, if the mission was just to free them, get them out of Egypt and say, go, live your life, discover who you are, then it's already been accomplished. But the purpose is not just simply to free a people, but to form a people. And so he brings them to a mountain of formation. And they are called to be something, not so that they would be the children of God, not that they would earn it or deserve it. No, they've already been called out. Now they are given an identity. See, God has already called them out of Egypt. Now he's telling them, here's the family DNA. This is what it looks like to be what's already true of you in your calling. And so we go to Exodus chapter 19. How are you guys doing? It's a lot of Bible today. Sorry. I'm not sorry. It's Calvary Bible Church. Okay. Chapter 19. They set out from Rephidim and came into the wilderness of Sinai, and they encamped in the wilderness. There Israel encamped before, see what it says, the mountain of God. While Moses went up to God, the Lord called to him out of the mountain, saying, thus you shall say to the house of Jacob and tell the people of Israel, you yourselves have seen what I did to the Egyptians and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. I love that. What a line. Not just, hey, I got you out of Egypt. I busted you out of slavery. I brought you to myself. Like, what's happening here? It's like it's a wedding ceremony. I brought you out of slavery and bondage to myself. Because the heart of God is to be with his people and the people of God to be with him in relationship. I brought you to myself. Now, therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, you shall be, this is what he says to Israel, my treasured possession among all peoples. For all the earth is mine, and you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words that you shall speak to the people of Israel. He's going to give them a new identity. You see, Egypt imposed an identity on them. You are slave. You are nothing more than commodity. You produce or we remove you. And here God says, no, you are my people that I have chosen. You are holy. set apart. You are a priesthood. What does a priesthood do? A priesthood displays the glories of God to the world around him. A priesthood is the one that mediates a relationship between man and God. And so what God has done in the unfolding of his plan is now to call a people for his own possession out of all the peoples of the earth so that they would display to the earth, be a blessing to the earth. It's the same language of Abraham. I'm going to bless you to bless others. I'm going to call you out holy, set you apart for a purpose that you would be a royal priesthood, display who I am to the world. That the world would come to me. So he's called them this. This is the identity. And now we find the beginning of these 10 words. We call them the 10 commandments. And remember, they're not commands that you do these things to become the people of God. No, remember, I've already done the work. By grace, I've already saved you. You come to the mountain by grace through faith of following me here. Now these marks are the marks of being the people of God. Not simply to become, but to be, to keep, to stay, to abide as the people of God. This is what sets you apart from all the nations around you. This is the DNA of the family. There's 10 commandments. You have 10 fingers. Throw them out. Can you name the 10 commandments? Just quietly in your own heart right now. Fold a finger every time you get one. Can you do it? Can you do it by yourself? Can you name all 10? Like the formational identity of the people of God. Maybe you get 3. Maybe you're like above average and you get 7. C students, come on, let's do it. C's are for degrees. D's are for diplomas. Can you get all 10? We should know 10 commandments. Not that they're imposed on people that don't want to follow God, heaven forbid. But as those who have chosen to follow God, to know the DNA of the family. So here they are. Chapter 20, verse 1, and God spoke all these words saying, I am the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery. That's the freedom. Now comes the formation. You shall have no other gods before me. So he is the supreme, ultimate affection of our life. And anything else that is lesser has no place being in the position of foremost, ultimate in our life. Have no other gods before me. He's like, keep God as the ultimate affection, the ultimate attention of your life. And if there's anything that really occupies that ultimate position in your life, I mean, like you can't imagine living without this, it's time to say to God, God, I recognize that you and you alone live here and nothing else, no one else, you alone. So no other gods before me. In Egypt, there were lots of gods before God. Not so for the people of God. 2, you shall not make for yourself a carved image or any likeness of anything that is in heaven above or that is in the earth beneath or that is in the water underneath. You shall not bow down to them or serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third or fourth generation of those who hate me, but showing steadfast love to thousands of those who love me and keep my commandments. Make no images of anything in the sky or the sea or the earth, and worship them. Remember, worship is a human activity in which we attribute worth and we give it our attention. We schedule our life around it. We give our resources to it. We hope that it would continue on, and that's the worship of humanity. He says, don't do that with anything that's created. Don't make images of anything that has been created and worship it. Now, what does he mean by don't make images of God? Because God's already made an image. Remember from the Genesis story? God said, let us make humanity, male and female, in our likeness, in our image, let us make humanity. And so if we make images, we disgrace the image of God and fundamentally reject God himself. And so we have no business to make images and worship the things that are created. For God has already told us, you bear the image of God. Why would you, as an image bearer, create images that are such less than the thing that God has made to be the image and worship it? Worship one another. No gods before me, no images. Third one says this, you shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, for the Lord will not hold him guiltless who takes his name in vain. Oftentimes that's reduced to just like use the name of Jesus after you smash your thumb with a hammer. It's like no cussing with God's name in it. It's so much more than that. To take something in vain is to take something without purpose, or vain in the sense of being empty. And to take a name on yourself is to identify yourself with that team, so to speak, and to do it in such a way that is in a vain or empty or meaningless way for the character and nature of that name. So imagine you are on a sports team for a school, and you wear the jersey. It has the name of the school on the front of it, and it has your name on the back of it, and you have chosen to take that name on you, and then you go live a life that is contradictory to the values and character and nature of that school's institution. What someone would come to you and say is, why have you bared our name in vain? Like, you don't stand up for what we value, what we stand up for. What God is saying is, don't take the name of God on your life in an empty, vain, meaningless way. For the Lord doesn't just keep us guiltless for those who do that. That's what it means to take the Lord's name in vain in our life. So don't say, I follow God, and then go live contrary to all the things that God has called you to. That's to take his name in vain. Does that make sense? It's so much more than saying his name when you hurt your thumb. And then he says in 8, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work, but the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter, your male servant, your female servant, your livestock, or the sojourner, immigrant within your gates. For in 6 days the Lord made heaven and earth and sea and all that is in them and rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. He set apart. So here's the work-rest rhythm of God's people that is totally different than the world around them. And Israel needs to know this as part of their identity, that 6 days they labor and the seventh they cease. And the reason it's so important is because that is fundamentally a different identity than what Egypt told them who they were. In Egypt, they worked 7 days a week. And their identity is reduced to this in Egypt. How many bricks did you make today? What'd you produce for the empire? You are as good and valuable as what you can produce for us. And God says, oh, that's not how I view you. And to remind you that that's not who you are and how I view you, I need you to work and then cease from your production and know that it's I who make your work fruitful. It's I who provide for you. It's I that give you life. Just like in the creation story, I rested from production. You too rest from production. And every week remind yourself this. You are not simply the sum total of what you can make. Do you think that would be helpful for those coming out of slavery? Do you think it'd be helpful for those in America to be reminded that their identity with God is so much greater than what they can produce? This is a formational moment to be a people set apart from all the cultures of busyness and production to display as a priesthood the goodness of God. I love it that God puts that in the commandment. It's like, here's the world comes to these Israelites who are resting from production on the seventh day, and they're like, man, why are you resting? Why are you sleeping? Why are you lazy? And you're like, because God commanded I stop and rest. How good is God? He says, you want to obey me? You want to follow me? You need to rest. Take some time off. Stop working. Recuperate. Be reminded of how I will care for you in all of your production. So good. Now here are the next five, and they go a little bit quicker. First five is the first one with the promise. It's funny, there's no promise to no gods before me or no images. This is the first one with the promise. Verse 12, honor your father and your mother that your days may be long in the land that the Lord your God is giving you. The first one is a family command. Honor your father and mother that communally it will go well. It means like humans will flourish in the land. The flourishment of the community begins in the family. The health of the community can only be as healthy as the family. And the family's health is rooted in how we view mom and dad. You can think about all these stories of Jacob and Abraham. It's like, this is a mess of not honoring mom and dad, of not taking these things seriously that they didn't know about yet. He's forming them as a people, and he's forming them as a family. And the community's health, that it might go well with you, that it would flourish in the land, begins with the family. I love this. Being in Uganda, we were watching the graduates of kids that had gone through sponsorship, coming off the streets, being educated, clothed, equipped, and now they're graduating from school. And this one young woman comes up, and she in her speech, she says, I want to thank my mother. She gave me life, and I honor her for it. And you're like, wow, that must be the best mom ever. Her mother abandoned her at birth. And the reason she said thank you to mom was simply only because she's the source of her life. And that was honorable. She gave me life. And I honor her. I honor the position of motherhood. I honor fatherhood. Why? Because they're perfect people? No, not at all. Because the family matters. It's the first one with a promise. Then very quickly, you shall not murder. I don't harbor hate in your life so much that you would go and destroy someone. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife, his male servant, his female servant, or his ox, or his donkey, or his Porsche, or his vacation, or his Disney adventure. Nothing! Anything in his house. Why? These are communal commands of how we love one another. Because if you're envious and you covet everything your neighbor has, you cannot love them. You cannot celebrate them. You can't celebrate their successes, their victories, because you're always envious of them, wanting them for yourself. It does not build a community that flourishes. Everything in here is really the beginning establishment of the Western culture of like private property. That there's such a thing as private property, and you don't have access to other people's stuff. Don't steal it. There are so many implications of just these commands of how we are living in the reality of our life that's been instituted from this. Now, Jesus had said, when asked, what's the greatest command? Love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. On these two commands, all the law hangs. And you look at the Ten Commandments, and they're divided into those two sections. How do you love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength? That's the first four. No other gods, no images, no worship, no vain. Remembering the Sabbath, to trust in him. And everything else is horizontal, your relationship with others. Is how do you love your neighbor as you love yourself? Don't kill him. How about don't hate him? Don't break apart relationships by stealing or adultery. Don't bear false witness. That's not just not lying. That is, hey, we're trying to figure out the reality of our community, what happened. You may not come in and distort reality. You must tell the truth of reality. That's what that means. And then you can't covet. Like that's, you don't can't love your neighbor if you covet. Love God, love others. What are we doing here at Calvary? We're building a Christ-centered community of people fully devoted to doing what? Loving God and loving others. It's the Ten Commandments. It's the frame, because we're the people of God. Now, they get these Ten Commandments, these ways of being the people, and they lived happily ever after. So Moses gets these commandments, and he comes off the mountain, and what are they doing? They have a calf that they made an image of. Before God, like seriously, literally, before the mountain of God. They're worshiping it. Taking the name of the Lord in vain. And it's like, oh man, this covenant in which Moses is the mediator of will work by the shedding of blood of goats and lambs and bulls, but it will not work to take away the sins of people. We need a new mediator and we need a new covenant. And really quickly, with time expiring, it's promised. This is Deuteronomy chapter 18. Moses says this, then God says this, the Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me, so like a mediator of a covenant, like me from among you, from your brothers. He's gonna be Jewish, he's gonna be an Israelite. It is in him you shall listen. Verse 18, I will raise up from them a prophet like you, Moses, from among their brothers, and I will put my words in his mouth, and he shall speak to them all that I command him. This new mediator will bring a new covenant. And the new covenant is what Jeremiah says is going to happen. Jeremiah 31, 31, behold, the days are coming, declares the Lord, when I will make a new covenant with the house of Israel and the house of Judah, not like the covenant that I made with their fathers on the day that I took them by the hand to bring them out of the land of Egypt. My covenant that they broke, though I was their husband, declares the Lord. For this is the covenant that I will make with them, the house of Israel, for those days, declares the Lord. I will put my law within them and I will write it on their hearts. I will be their God and they shall be my people. Like not on stone, sort of heart, always rebelling against God. I'm gonna put my ways on their heart. What's on the heart? Desires. I'm gonna make their heart desire the things of God. This is the mark of the children of God. We desire. Doesn't mean we do it perfectly, but we desire to do the things of God because he's written it on our hearts. The mediator of this new covenant by the work of the Spirit is none other than Jesus Christ. Amen. Peter says this explicitly in Acts chapter 3. The one that Moses said is coming, the mediator, is Jesus Christ. Stephen proclaimed this at his death in Acts chapter 7. The Hebrews, the writer of Hebrews in chapter 3 says, I better Moses is here. Moses was a servant in the household of God. Jesus is the son of the household of God, and he brings a new and better covenant. And so we are obedient to the law of Christ. The law of Christ is the law of love. How do we love God and love others? It's formational as the people of God. And it gives us an identity. I'll end with this. Those who believe in the work of Jesus Christ that comes from the cross are in this new covenant. And the new covenant, being the people that have been called out of sin and death, are given a new identity. And this is the identity of the people of God. If you want to know who I am, if you want to have an identity that gives you purpose and passion, meaning, direction, vision, mission for your life, comes out of this identity. Church, if you believe in Jesus Christ, if you've entrusted yourself in his work, this is who you are. You ready? 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 9. You are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for his own possession, that you may proclaim the excellencies of him who called you out of darkness into marvelous light. Once you were not a people, but now you are God's people. Once you had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy. All the ways in which we have broken the commandments, mercy has come to meet us and forgive us. So who are you? You are chosen. You are royal. You are a priesthood. This is parallel language of Sinai for those in the covenant of Christ. Why are you that? That you might proclaim to the world in word and deed the excellencies of who God is, the one who called you out of darkness into marvelous light. Let's pray. Father, I thank you that you give us an identity rooted in the work of Jesus Christ on the cross. Praise God for the cross. It gives us not only freedom from sin, freedom from death, but it gives us an identity of who we are to live and how to live in this world. And so, Lord, with the world that is in such distress, may we live as a kingdom of priests, holy, set apart, looking different than the world around us. proclaiming who God is, that the world too might come to him out of darkness to light and life. It's in the name of Christ we pray. Amen.